Can you tell me what your mother thought about women's suffrage?
Pardon? What my mother
thought? What your mother thought, yes. Did she have any views about women's suffrage at all?
About women's suffrage? Oh, yes. She was for it.
Was she?
She was, yes. Not very. She wasn't in at all a political sort of mind, but...
Yes.
But on grounds of social justice and so on, she was in favour.
Mm.
But it was my elder sister, the elder of the two sisters,
yes,
who was more the moving spirit in that.
Mm.
She did rather strongly approve of it,
mm.
but she never did any speaking for it or anything like that.
What was that? The school teacher?
She was
teacher.
A teacher.
Yes, yes.
She was a teacher who specialised in history.
Mm.
And.
She just went to meetings and things like that, did she?
Yes, she and the two sisters both went to meetings occasionally.
Mm.
And I went to a WSPU meeting. I went to two. There was the one I told you about, which ended in a rap uproar. And there was another. And what was the name of that one that my mother liked very much? Speaker. She was there.
Mrs. Pethick Lawrence?
Pardon?
Mrs. Pethick Lawrence, was it?
No, it was not Mrs. Bethy Barnes.
Mrs. Billington Grieg?
No. I should think of it if I heard the word, I should know at once.
Mm.
Anyhow, she was very keen on this particular speaker.
Yes.
And she liked some of the others rather.
Not Annie Kenny, was it?
Oh, not Annie Kenny, no.
No. I don't know who it would be.
I knew Annie Kenny's brother very well later.
Did you?
But I don't remember her, mm. though I think I saw her on the platform once.
Mm. Were your sisters in favour of the WSPU then, rather than the NUWSS?
They didn't know so much about the pacifist one, or I think mm. they would have been on the side of the moderates and the pacifist mm. ones, rather.
Mm. Mm.
But then the WSPU was the one that made most noise.
Mm,
it was the one that was most advertised, if I seem to remember
it's
right.
Quite true, yes.
And therefore they knew it best, and those were the meetings that they happened to go to.
Mm.
But they were never presented with the choice between the two attitudes to it, you know, as far as I know.
No, I see. What about your father? Was he in favour of women's suffrage?
My father didn't like it much. He was not in favour, really. He didn't.
Mm.
I think he thought it was one of these modern movements, you know, mm. that's not going to cut much ice in the end.
What about sort of attitudes in the congregational chapel you went to?
Well, of course, that was interesting. That there was. I never remember it getting on the platform there, and you know, it was one of those omnicompetent nonconformist churches with a large parish of its own, mm. and with. something every night of the week as well as Sundays. They were very busy people. They did a lot, and they did a lot. They really carried on a lot of very good higher education. You know, the lectures they used to provide and so on were often very valuable. I mean, looking back on those days, I think I got quite a lot from the life of the church in the weekdays.
What sort of things?
Well, there was a social union which had nearly every week there was a meeting which was really of some cultural nature. I saw my first moving pictures there. There were lectures which would be scientific occasionally Oh yes, there were sort of philosophical and scientific lectures as well. They all had a religious slant in a way, that imposed upon them, I suppose, more a little bit.
And then, did you have outings and?
And well, there were outings too. Yes, we had outings. We used to go to places not very far outside London. London was less big than it is now, you know, even then.
Mm.
Of course, it was even those days I'm talking of were the 90s.
When you were a teenager?
The 90s, when I was a teenager.
mm. But no women's suffrage there?
the 90s and the very earliest years of the century, went on into then, there was still, and one must remember that was a time when there was still a fair number of the good nonconformist preachers. And you know, they were very capable and powerful men, many of these.
You learned a lot from them.
They were men who knew a lot and communicated a lot in their sermons, as well as religious dogmas and bases. But besides that, there was a cultural ambience to all of everything they said, you see, which was, of course, the liberal culture of the day.
Was it culture in the sense of poetry, history, literature?
And there was the left wing, which used to get rather extremer things. For example, Bernard Shaw came and addressed us, and very much shocked some of the members of the congregation, I remember. I didn't see him. I was not taken to that meeting. I was young enough to have been taken. If I had gone, I would not have gone on my own, I don't suppose.
But were women prominent in the running of things?
Yes. Oh, yes. In any church society of that kind, you'll find they are. And you must remember that there were plenty of very well-educated women at that time.
Who hadn't been to university, but still needed...
Who had not been to university, no. University women were very... There were a few. Girton existed, you see. But Girton was publicised partly as a figure of fun, you know, in those days.
But you didn't hear women's suffrage discussed in the meetings there at all?
I never heard it discussed on the platform of the Corbin Hall, where we have most of our meetings. No, I don't remember that I ever did. Though I heard discussions of it going on among members from time to time. Only little bits of it, because I didn't get interested to the point of wanting to discuss the theory of it much.
No. But when did you first come across the women's suffrage movement as such? I mean, when did you first...
Oh, through my sisters. Through my sisters and my... my mother, so far as she was drawn in at all, she hadn't much time. She'd got a very big job on her hand.
Bringing up the children, you mean?
Well, yes, you see, doing a family of the size she had, on the income she had, and the enormous amount of work she used to put in, their clothes and so on, the contribution she made to that, you see, was formidable. She was at the sewing machine nearly every night for a long time.
So she had no time to join in meetings?
She had no time much for that kind of thing, no.
So which was the first meeting you went to, women's suffrage meeting you went to?
The first one I can remember, though I doubt if it was really the first, and I didn't go to a great many, you know, was the one I told you about at the Alexandra Palace.
Can you tell me again about it? Tell me everything that happened.
but I can't remember it well enough for that. But they came... The roughs of the neighbourhood turned up and determined in advance to break up the meeting, I think. At that time, they had it in the part of the Alexandra Palace which was used as the theatre and which was indeed equipped for very presentable theatrical productions. I saw the production of an opera, Carmen, there once. There was room for an orchestra and there were dressing rooms and all. They could do quite a lot. But they did have this WSBU meeting there, and it was addressed by one of the, I forget who the main first speaker was, and then Christabel spoke. And I felt a good deal of sympathy for Christabel. She was, you know, she looked rather nice among the lot, and she seemed to me to be doing it rather well. But of course they didn't let her get far before they started, the pandemonium began. And I was very annoyed at the pandemonium because I thought it was spoiling the sport for everybody, you see. And I got to move to the point that I did jump up on my chair and face back. It was the gallery. They had monopolized the gallery, these Tufts, you see. And waving my arms about, you see, I addressed them in as stentorian tones as I could arouse, as I could muster, and told them that they were insulting a brave woman, you see, and that it was a very wrong and cowardly thing to do, and it was to everybody a disadvantage, and so on. I said one or two of the sort of obvious things you can shout in a case like that, in the hope of being heard above the din, and possibly I was, partly. She tried speaking against the noise very bravely for some time, not very successfully. And then the Tufts began to swarm, decided they would storm the platform. And I got involved in the melee a bit. I didn't get hurt, which was surprising. Perhaps I was not aggressive enough to get to become a marked man and get hurt much. I remember it was very inconvenient. One was jostled and pushed about a bit, but then it quieted down because some people began to remove some of the furniture, and the bad boys went out, you see, thinking that they'd done what they wanted to do, really. They stopped the meeting, you see.
Were you the only person who stood up and tried to stop the roughs?
No, I was the first. I think one or two tried to do something. I don't know that one tried. I really tried to harangue the audience. They didn't try that.
What made you do it, do you think?
Yeah, there you see, is a case of, at that time, I was a shocking stammerer. But it made no difference at all when I wanted to harangue the crowd. I was not my usual self at all. And I'm sure I had no difficulty at all about speaking, about forming the words. I had difficulty in choosing the right ones.
But why did you do it, really? Because you didn't really feel passionately about women's suffrage. You never have you? Well, why did you?
No, well, I felt it was a sort of chivalrous impulse, very largely. You see, you got this young woman, not bad looking in a way. Christopher was never pretty, but she was not. She had a good deal of the charm of her young years. She was well under 20 at that time, I think. She might have been only 18 or so. And I felt that it was a very, I felt there was a barbarity about it all that ought to be rebuked. You see, that was really the sort of feeling I had. It was not so much because I was very sympathetic with the cause. I don't think I was awfully, not to an extreme extent. I was just like a great many of the men I knew, a lukewarm sympathiser, and hoped it would come to a good parliamentary conclusion, you see.
Were you ever a member of the Men's League?
No, I never joined the Men's League. There was one. I remember that there was one. And funnily enough, perhaps because I was too young, I was never canvassed or invited to join. Which, now I think is a little bit odd, but then perhaps I was looked upon as too young. Not important enough. They were out for more showy people.
You never actually joined the women's suffrage.
I never joined. No, I never did.
No, you just went along to a few meetings and
I went to a few meetings and discussed it with friends a bit, you see. But I never read books about it.
It was just one of the good causes around.
It was one of the good causes around which one sympathised with, and one was prepared to do something for if the opportunity arose.
But of course, Lawrence Houseman was a keen woman suffrage man, wasn't he?
Oh, Houseman! Houseman was a keen. I think he was one of the moving spirits of the Men's League, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
Probably.
And he wrote a lot in their periodicals and things like that.
Oh, yes.
But a lot of the people you mixed with, you see, were quite active, weren't they? I mean, a lot of the people at Chipping Campden, Maud Royden, Lawrence Hausman, and all those artists sort of groups were really very sympathetic, weren't they?
Yes, I think Ashby would have been sympathetic after a point. I think it's very probable that Mrs. Ashby was quite keen.
Why do you think artists were so keen on women's suffrage? I mean, the whole world of literature and art and so on seems to be involved with women's suffrage.
Don't you think that it's partly because women have not, even then, women did not really have disabilities, or not grave disabilities, in those cultural spheres.
So they have prominence
there. They have prominence there, and their cause naturally had prominence there. And the sort of men who would be prominent in them would be, on the whole, friendly to them, you see, about it. I think that's more or less the general reason for it.
It's not something about the artistic temperament, you know, sort of sympathising with, humanitarian...
Well, you can say that people with what is called artistic temperament are inclined to be a little more welcoming to any new movement of liberation of that type, you see.
And less political in their attitudes.
But not so political, not so much on the political ground of it. I mean, I never had any reason to think that there was very much really good thinking out of the implications of women's suffrage or what women could particularly do. There wasn't, you know. And as a matter of fact, they did very little. When they got the vote, for a long time, there was a great backlash because people felt, well, now we've got the vote and what do we do? Nothing. It makes very little difference. Politics, whether a woman is in it or a man, and in politics, is much the same kettle of fish.
Yes, I agree. I quite agree with that. There is an element of the anti-political in the whole movement. I mean, there's just a distaste for politicians and for parliament and for everything that's frustrating and obvious justice, you know. And I would have thought that artists would tend to show this impatience.
Artists have always tended to be on the libertarian side because they are always, in a certain spiritual sense, a little bit of an oppressed minority themselves.
Yes, how do you mean? I mean,
you see, they really reject the utilitarian standards, which are perhaps naturally and necessarily dominant in the society, and all the more so in a highly civilized society, because it becomes more complicated and technical.
I think there's something in the, I mean, there's clearly something anti-political about the whole movement. I mean, a distaste for Asquith, for compromise, all these things. For sort of day-to-day routine, for everything that's associated with bargaining. I mean, they just insist on what they want and
yes, the emotional element, you see, is too strong on the women's side always. It tends to be undisciplined on the women's side.
There's another thing, you see, that I think's noticeable, and this is really particularly why I'm interested to discuss it with you, because I've noticed that a lot of foreigners or Jews who are also quite active in this movement, and I wonder whether you could explain why that's so, if it is so. I mean, you see, Golanx, the Lowies, the Guggenheim, the young man at the London School of Economics. I mean, there are just a lot of people of this sort with foreign connections of one sort or another. I wonder why you think it is.
Well, of course, the Jews are not interested to the limit in any one civilization. Because they are in this sense the most civilized people on earth, and always will be, that they have been through all the civilizations and have been rejected by all of them.
Mm.
So they naturally have a rather critical eye on civilization itself anyhow.
But I suppose the explanation is, in a sense, that all immigrants are minorities in the society, and they have a sympathy with any other oppressed minorities who happen to be campaigning at the time.
Yes, that certainly is true.
Because there's also a strong connection between liberalism and Jewish minorities, or if you were a foreigner, you tended to vote. If you were a foreign immigrant to England, you tended to vote liberal, didn't you? Broadly speaking,
you would vote either liberal or else
or Labour.
Or else Labour, and you might be tempted rather to go extreme left.
Mm. And your father, for instance, didn't consider voting Conservative, except in 1886, as a Swiss man in England.
No, he was a Gladstonian from the start, you see.
Mm.
Most educated Swiss coming to England would have been Gladstonians.
Mm. Mm. I don't know why, really. I mean, I suppose it's just that Gladstone stands for sort of European civilization.
Yes, it's really, you see, liberalism has roots in the whole of Europe, in the whole of European life.
Mm. Mm. Anyway, you went to this meeting where you stood up and spoke. You went to another, you remember another women's suffrage meeting you went to?
Oh yes, I can remember another very well, and I wish I... I wonder whether I saw Mrs. Corbett Ashby, as she then was, at that meeting. Now I rather suspect I did. And it was held at the Northern Polytechnic, Holloway Road, North London. I don't know whether you know the map of North London well, do you?
Yes.
Mm. Well, you would know where the Northern Polytechnic is, probably.
Mm. Mm.
I used to go there for concerts. We had some very good concerts, orchestral concerts and so on, some of which I remember very well. And this meeting was held there. And it was the best meeting I had been to for the standard of women speaking. The oratory was good.
Who was talking actually then?
Well, now they were, you got me there, you see.
Not Mrs.
My memory of a time like that is actually very good in some ways, but not with regard to names.
No, no, why? I just wondered if you remember.
They'll disappear completely.
Why did it stick with you, that meeting, and why did the recollection stick with you? Just because of the quality of the speaking?
I think it was, because I thought, especially compared with the first one I'd been at, which was a rowdy affair and ending in an awful ship, in an awful scrimmage.
Mm.
This was a really properly conducted and well-conducted meeting.
Mm. Mm.
And one in which some of the speakers made you think a bit, you see, which I always regarded as a merit in a speaker.
Yes, actually, you're quite right. I don't think any great book emerged from the women's suffrage movement. I mean, you'd think that a movement like that would have produced a great book of some sort.
There was the lack of, you see... There were a lot of other feminist movements on the continent. There was a lot of feminism about, but it never took any forms which could cut much ice in the English liberal atmosphere.
Why not, do you think, really?
I think it was partly because they never did the thinking required, and somehow nobody prompted them to do the thinking required. You see, when you read things like, remember the books they did read? Things like, who was that one, that woman who wrote Story of an African Farm?
Olive Schreiner.
Olive Schreiner. Mm. There were some about like that, you see, whom people liked in a way. They thought them a rather good literary artists. And then, of course, there were things like, Otto Weininger was going about.
Mm.
Otto Weininger.
And there was
whereas Weininger was important in the intelligentsia of the continent, I don't think he ever cut any ice in England. I read him because Mitrinovich put me on to Weininger.
Mm.
But otherwise, I should
Ibsen,
never
of course.
Pardon?
Ibsen.
And there was Ibsen. Oh, Ibsen. Now, Ibsen was important.
Mm. Mm.
Yes, Ibsen was very important.
Mm. And also, of course, Mill. I mean, the best book on women's liberties is written by a man in 1869.
But, you know, it's a funny thing. In my adolescent years, when I just knew the existence of Mill, and I knew that he wrote an essay on liberty or something like that, I didn't read it, you know.
Yes.
I didn't hear it.
No.
Discuss.
But my point was simply that, I mean, the only really great book, or moderately great book, that's come out of the movement has in fact been written by a man, and didn't come out of the Edwardian suffrage movement. It came out of the mid-Victorian suffrage movement. That's curious, isn't it, really?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
Mill's Subjection of Women.
Yes.
I mean, you would have thought that
what is it entitled?
The Subjection of Women.
Oh, it is called The Subjection of Women. I haven't read it.
Yes. No reason why you should, particularly, but, I mean, it just shows you, I mean, that...
But I should like to read it.
It's an interesting book, and it was very influential on the
because
main
Mill,
line.
Because Mill was a very fine intellect.
Yes. Did you ever join in any women's processions at all? I mean, you weren't that close to the movement, really, were
no.
you? No. You never joined in any sort of... And you never knew Mrs. Pankhurst?
No, I never got to know... I never got to know one of them personally until Maud Royden.
No.
On quite other grounds I got to know her.
Yes. You first met her as an university extension lecturer,
yes.
didn't you?
Yes.
Can you explain to me, I mean, you see, this is an interesting...
There
thing.
She thrilled me.
Yes, why?
Well, she was a very good speaker. And then, you see, her mental level was very good, you know. Oh, yes, it was good.
The thing is, she...
She gave us two great courses, I remember. One was Shakespeare, where she went through the whole corpus of the Shakespeare plays and gave good popular lectures, expository lectures, you see. They were very much, it seems to me, I got to think myself a little while later, who was the great popular expositor at that time? Oh, you know his name. He wrote a lot. He wrote...
Not Chesterton. Chesterton?
No, more academic than that.
Gilbert Murray?
No, he's a bit earlier too. Oh, I might think of it, but I very much it won't, because I haven't thought of him for a long time. But he was rather a good writer on Shakespeare.
Oh, I see, not Bradley.
Yes, Bradley. That's just the man I mean.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Bradley held the floor at that time.
Yes.
Well, I think that her lectures wouldn't tell you much that you couldn't have found in Bradley.
I see, they weren't particularly original, but they were very...
They were not very
inspiring.
Original, but they were very eloquent.
Yes, I see.
And they were done with a kind of spirit that was infectious and good.
Mm. The thing is, you see, I mean...
She was a great spiritual stimulant, you know. There was something very good
about
her. That's
precisely what Marjorie Corbett Asprey said, you see, this afternoon. I mean,
yes.
See, it's very difficult for me to understand, because it's clear that her distinction, the reason why she made an impact on contemporaries was because she had some very ephemeral quality that isn't conveyed in prose, you know, so I can't understand
that's
it now.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, it's speaking ability, spiritual communication or something.
Yes, yes.
Which infected contemporaries, but doesn't last.
No, I agree. I think that she would be very difficult to, I think, to write a book on her and recreate anything of her in literature would be very difficult. Mm. I think that's one reason. Somebody was saying, Kathleen Courtney said, how strange that nobody's written a biography.
Mm.
But I don't think it is strange. I think it would be difficult to do.
Yes, I agree. Anyway, she clearly made a great impact on, not only on your life, but on many other people.
On many other people, yes. Oh, yes, she did.
Mm.
She was important. She was important in her time.
Did she ever talk to you about women's suffrage? I mean, what...
Oh, yes.
I mean...
Oh, yes, but I don't remember specific things she said that I couldn't have got or didn't get from other people as well.
Mm.
And in the conversations I had with her, Later on, of course, there were many, and I had the benefit of a great deal of her conversation. It was not. It was never much specifically on the woman question.
No, no.
She wasn't. It was Beth by no means the only arrow in her quiver.
No, I understand.
Not by any means. Mm. She was a theologian.
She was.
She knew a lot.
She knew a lot about.
And she had literature. She had literary ability and literary insight and some artistic insight. I remember her giving a lantern lecture on the Renaissance painters, which at that time was rather my subject. I was studying at the Tahoe School of Art at that time, and it was well done. She couldn't do it.
Was she a beautiful woman?
Well, no. She beauty of a kind, yes. You see, she had this like deformity of her lameness. And there was something very striking about the look of her face and head. She had very dark, very black hair, very dark, and she had very appealing and luminous eyes. Her eyes were very good. And she had the big mouth of an orator. I think you'll find that good orators very often have rather large mouths. But beauty, no, you wouldn't, nobody would have said, people would have said that the form of her facial features was a bit unfortunate.
Not regular or shapely.
No,
but
it wasn't.
When she spoke to you, I mean, as
but she was expressive. There was always a great expressiveness about her about all her features, her facial features.
If she was talking to you as I am now, she'd make an impact less by her appearance than by the way she sympathised with you or looked at you, would she? I mean.
Oh yes, I think that's true. And of course, I was always fascinated by what she said.
Yes, yes.
I mean, she used words very well. And I was always, I'm a person who was always from the start amenable to work by somebody who couldn't use words well.
Yes, yes, I understand.
Mitrinovich had his power over me because he was a wizard with words, and in several languages in his case.
Did you have any men friends who were active in the women's suffrage movement? I mean, did you move in those circles really at all?
No.
You were really
no, and you see, as it happens, although my sisters were keen on the movement and cultivated it quite a bit, they never made the sort of men's friends that she could bring to the house who were likely to be in the men's league, for example.
No,
that they didn't make that kind of man friend.
Mm. What kind of man friend, really? I mean, what sort of men supported women's?
Well, my younger sister, who was the one who was sort of destined for marriage, and my older sister was not. My older sister was a very fine elder sister to have. In fact, she was the leading spirit of the family. She was the one who really always got the family doing things and showed them how to do things and all that kind of thing. She was a born elder sister and teacher. I put that upon her tombstone because I felt it was the description for her. She was a born elder sister and teacher.
Well, why was she a suffragette?
And of course, pardon?
Why was she a suffragette?
I think she got that chiefly from one of her friends. She had women friends. She always had an important woman friend on the go. And they tended to be intellectual ones. One of the first and most important was a religious woman who was the head of a branch of the Young Women's Christian Association. She became rather a disciple of this woman, who was an admirable woman. I think very highly of her, what I remember of her now.
So it was personal influence that...
But that was a specifically religious influence, you see.
Mm.
But then there were others of a more purely intellectual type, and sometimes not religious at all, but rather the other way about, among her colleagues with the schools in which she taught.
Mm. Mm. So she naturally...
She imbibed a bit from the women's teacher, from the women teachers she mixed with, she imbibed a good deal of the...
Because women teachers were very active in the movement.
Yes, they were active, and they were the ones who caught... That was through them that she got caught up in it, and probably my other sister also.
Mm.
Because her teacher friends would come to the house, and we became very friendly with some of them and went to their houses, you see. My older sister was of the type... She always made a little bit of a social affair, you see, of anything she got involved in, because she had the gift for it.
Yes, I see. Yeah. That's very interesting, because you mentioned both the Alexandra Palace meeting and Maud Royden in your letter, and those were the two things I wanted to follow up with you. The thing is very interesting is the very important part that the dissenting chapel played in your whole recreational life, really.
Oh, very important. And that was the case in a good many what might be called nonconformist church parishes. They were not parishes, of course, in any legal sense.
Yeah.
But they ministered to as many as would come from a certain area. And they nearly always had a very competent preacher at the centre.
Yes, I can believe that.
Nearly all.
Were women's suffrage meetings that you went to anything like revival meetings? I mean, were they like...
Oh, no. No, I wouldn't say that. They were like political meetings, I have to believe.
Little rational speeches, really. I mean,
a lot of rational speaking, yes, and a good deal more emotional speaking, perhaps. A bit more emotional
but
speaking.
But not a come-to-Jesus sort of thing about them at all. No.
I wouldn't be able to characterise them very accurately.
Oh, you can't really generalise on two. No. No, that's very interesting, Mr. Mayor. You have been very, very helpful. I don't think I wanted to ask you anything else unless, you know, you had any other contacts with the women's movement that you didn't mention in your letter, apart from Maud Royden and just going to some of the meetings. You really caught up in your artistic concerns
and
at that
course,
time.
And, of course, Hausmann.
And Hausmann. You mentioned that there's a marvellous description in your autobiography of Hausmann entertaining company.
Oh yes, I admired his brilliance.
Because again, he's a figure who's declined in reputation, hasn't he?
Oh yes.
I mean, he's not really nothing to compare with his brother.
And he hasn't left anything very important, you see.
No.
There was one little play he wrote which was successful, that Grenville Barker put on.
Jingalo, was that?
Pardon?
Jingalo?
John of Jingalo is one of his, is a very clever book, which is a political skit.
Yes.
And it's very well done. I found that very, very interesting.
Yes.
But the one I'm thinking of was it was a little play. The Dren Barker people, you know, put it on.
Yes, Granville Barker.
And they made a success of it. He made a little money out of it. In fact, it went on for some time, so that... he drew quite a little income from that, but I cannot remember the title.
I don't know what it would be.
Some title like Scaramouche or something like that, but it wasn't that.
Yes. Well, who did he marry eventually? Because he's very vague about his personal life in his autobiography.
Well, you know, I wonder...
What happened?
I wonder whether both he and A.E. were not homosexuals.
I see, yes, I thought...
Think they were.
They
were odd. People. And of course Helston, Lawrence had a lot of women friends. And then, but then the curious thing about him, you know, he lived all his life with that sister.
Oh, that's, I see. I've got the impression he'd actually married, but he didn't marry. I see.
Oh, no, he never married. He couldn't, I don't think he could ever have married. It wouldn't have been practicable because the link with his sister, who I think needed him in her life. She was a rather good artist.
Was she? Yes, they certainly move in that sort of circle, don't they?
She did, she was an artist in black and white. She pen drawings. But they were very good. They were a little bit, there was a similarity between hers and his. Because he did offer pen drawings too, some of them very clever.
Yes.
But, what was her name? Clements.
That's right.
Clements Helston.
Yes, that's right. He mentions her.
They did, a few, not many years ago, well, it might be as much as 15 or so, they did a broadcast, they did a radio broadcast on the two Helstons.
Now, I think he's an interesting man, but I find it difficult to understand him.
He would be impossible to understand, as I think A. E. is too. I never met A. E., but friends of mine at Camden who did meet them both, their verdict was that they were, surely these were both very strange, very odd men. But of course we were not without experience of homosexuality, because Ashby was a great homosexual.
Was he? I didn't know that.
And of course a great friend, one of his greatest college friend was Lewis Dickinson.
Oh yes, I know he was
a homosexual too.
Yes. Of course the thing that's now, which is, I think there is an element of lesbianism also in the women's movement. I mean, if you look at, I mean, for instance, Mrs. Billington Greig, who's one of the prominent suffragists.
Ah, Billington. Ah, now, she is one of the speakers I do remember.
Do you?
And she was one of the speakers, though I think not the principal one, that my mother liked very much.
Oh, was she? Yes. Why did she like her?
Particularly liked her. Mm. Well, I don't know, it was something, it was a very personal sort of choice, which would not necessarily have been mine. Yes. But she felt a great personal quality and a personal charm about her.
She's a remarkable woman, actually.
I think she was.
I wish I'd met her.
I can faintly remember the look of her.
Yes.
And that there was something pleasing about the look of her.
Mm. She was a genuine working girl, of course, who came south with...
Was she?
Yes, from Lancashire. But she wrote some autobiographical notes, which are very interesting.
Did she?
Yes, very interesting. They've never been published, but I wish they...
Now, Annie Kenny was the sister of Roland Kenny, whom I knew very well, who was the first editor of the first Labour newspaper we had in this country, which was Daily Citizen, or was it the Daily... before the Daily Herald.
Labour Leader?
Christian
Commonwealth?
The Labour Leader was never a Daily.
Oh, no.
I'm speaking of a Daily.
I see. I don't know, then, in that case. I don't know.
I think the Citizen was the first.
Not the Clarion?
Oh, no. The Clarion, again, was not a weekly, not a Daily.
No, I don't know what the...
I'm old enough to have read the Clarion in its palmy days. But this was later.
Mm.
You see, the great watershed in that way was 1906, wasn't it?
Yes, oh yes.
I remember the change of 1906. And then, you see, I changed my place where I lived. I left London and went to Camden in 1906. And even in Camden, we were very well aware of the reverberations that the great liberal landslide had made, the world was now on a different track altogether as it was.
Yes, it was a great victory that, wasn't it?
Halevy is very good on that.
Yes, oh yes. Yes.
Having lived through it, I became politically conscious just at that time.
Mm.
and was interested in many of the things that were happening. I went to some political meetings and so on. And I was very struck by Halevi. He seemed to me to be summing up the issues of that time better than we did ourselves.
Yes, I think he's a fine historian, actually. There's no doubt
about it. Very fine perception, and also a very good estimation of how, of what things went wrong when they got to power. How practically none of the things that people, after a violently enthusiastic movement, got power to do, they did nothing.
So it was a great ministry. The 1996 ministry achieved a great deal, actually.
Oh, it achieved a great deal, but not what it achieved is not what the what the people have been agitating about. Not much of it.
No. Well, it really
some of them got extraordinarily sold. For example, one of the powerful movements that lifted them to power, and I was very much in this in the, because it was very much a nonconformist cause. Was the opposition to the educational reforms.
Yes, 1920.
Which, the cause of the nonconformists thought gave too much to the established church. Well, they lost on that, I think. I think the thing they did lose, really, on the whole, in fact. But still, it was, they were very sold. They expected, you see, that when after that election...
They get all that they
wanted.
They
get all they had been like this. They got nothing.
I was thinking about the achievements. I was thinking the welfare state and all that.
Well, the achievements were tremendous. And then, of course, the Labour Party began then, really. It was only, even then it was only, 18 members or something like that.
Very few.
I think we're less than 20. Anyhow, it was very few, but still, it was a parliamentary party. And one with a self-confidence and a verve, you see, and an amount of liberal sympathy in the country.
True, yes.
Which meant that it had a future.
Yes. I must tear myself away, you know. But you want to hear yourself, don't you?
Let me...
You want